Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
9/11, remembering what union members did and died for. And today on the show, the latest from the progressive populace, labor attorney Joyce Goldstein on the erosion of worker rights and the International Union of Operating Engineers. Good afternoon and welcome to the Friday, September 11th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. We have three guests on the show today. We're going to start things off with one of our regulars, Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist, twice monthly magazine of politics, economics, and general news for workers. And he's going to talk about his upcoming editorial, Make Trump the Loser. And this is really good because a lot of people are scratching their heads wondering, with all the things that Donald Trump has said and done over the last 3.5 years, you have to wonder why people are still supporting him. Right now, between 40% and 43% of Americans think Donald Trump is doing a good job. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's not a career politician. They need a businessman in the White House. And he's going to run down the events here the last couple of weeks. Our second guest today is Joyce Goldstein, noted labor attorney. She has practiced all around the country. GoldsteinGregel.com is a website. She's going to talk about two things. Number one, there was a recent ruling from the Ohio Supreme Court, which is quite fascinating. It involves workers who cannot claim the invasion of privacy after direct observation urine tests. Now, there's a lot of companies, because of the drug problem in America today, are asking that you be tested for drugs, rightly so. Well, in this case, and it was a 4-3 decision, the Supreme Court reversed a Court of Appeals decision which found two current and former Sterilite of Ohio employees had stated a valid claim for invasion of privacy based on the use of the direct observation method as part of Sterilite's mandatory substance abuse testing procedures. Apparently, somebody had to come in the room where they were doing the urine test and watch them. And that was the invasion of privacy. They were fired. They were fired. They were at will. No unions involved here. All right. So Joyce is going to talk about that. She's also going to get into the National Labor Relations Board, primarily their general counsel, Peter Robb, who comes from a union busting law firm. And he's kind of the gatekeeper at the National Labor Relations Board. And essentially, in his position, he can decide which cases go forward. And the cases that have involved unions and union rights have not gone forward. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. So she'll get into that. Our third guest today, as you know, today is the anniversary of the terrorist attacks in New York City. And then there was the flight over Pennsylvania. We'll be joined by Thomas Hart. Thomas is president of the International Union of Operating Engineers. This is Local 94 out of New York City. And they lost several members on that fateful day in New York City. He is going to relive that moment and talk about the fact that we can never forget what happened on this day in 2001. It's hard to believe it's been 19 years ago. Speaking of which, just a couple of things I want to run down. The New York City Police Department has a memorial website in honor of the law enforcement officers who lost their lives in connection with 9/11. And of course, there's the firefighters that perished on this day, 343 of them. Interesting posting here from Ed Kelly, who is the General Secretary Treasurer of the International Association of Firefighters. 343, he writes, the number that is forever etched in every firefighter's mind. We see it all year long. A phone number, a car license plate, maybe even a lottery number. It's a consistent reminder of our 343 brothers who sacrificed their lives participating in the single largest rescue mission in the history of the fire service. Since that day, the number has grown as we continue to lose more of our brothers and sisters to ground zero related cancers. However, the number 343 will always commemorate the ordinary men who did extraordinary things on our nation's darkest day. May they and all the others lost on September 11th never be forgotten, and may their families and loved ones always remain in our thoughts and prayers. Building trades. As a result of the attacks that occurred on this day 19 years ago, we honor and remember 61 members of the New York City building trades who died in the towers that day. While most New Yorkers were running away from Lower Manhattan, thousands of members of the trades literally ran toward the devastation to help in whatever way they could. And check this out. Nearly 10,000 construction workers volunteered to help clean up Ground Zero after that. Transit workers. Today we honor 3,000 transit workers who participated in the rescue and recovery effort at Ground Zero. The transit system restored service hours after the towers fell. Imagine that, hours after they fell. And then there's the flight attendants, 25 flight attendants, 8 pilots, and 3 customer service agents died on this day 19 years ago. And I'm going to take you to the AFL-CIO website. There's a posting here with Sarah Nelson. Sarah is the current president of the Association of Flight Attendants. Listen to what she says about this day in history.
Aviation security is personal to us. No matter the uniform we wear, the routes we fly, or the years we have worn our wings, we will always remember the events of September 11th. Lift up our heroes and do everything in our power to ensure the events are never repeated. Everything changed on September 11th, 2001. We are not only first responders to emergencies affecting the health and safety of our passengers and other crew members, we are also our nation's last line of defense in aviation security. This day highlights the tremendous bravery of flight attendants. Our heroes on those 4 fateful flights acted as first responders. They relayed the first intelligence of the day that alerted our nation and our fellow crew members on Flight 93, who in turn acted without reservation against evil, sacrificing their own lives to protect our country and the lives of countless others. The incredible pain of mourning our dear friends also inspired new acts of heroism as our profession changed forever. In our flight attendant union, we found comfort in one another and the courage to get back on airplanes to usher passengers and fellow crew members home to their loved ones. Across the industry, we are united in honoring our heroes. Our union encourages flight attendants around the globe to wear your AFA September 11th pin or a black ribbon under your traditional AFA pin during the month of September. But whether you choose to fly in tribute to our heroes or recognize the day in some other way, know that you are a part of a flight attendant family and that through our unity, we are strong, resourceful, and resilient. Never forget that it is our unity, our compassion for one another, and our resolve to protect all the freedoms of individual expression that make us strong. We will never forget our heroes, and we will always seek to honor their sacrifice with our actions, not only through our work for safer skies, but in the way we contribute to each of our communities at home and those that we visit around the world. 25 flight attendants, 8 pilots, 3 customer service agents died on September 11th. Today, every day, we honor their memory. We will never forget.
Again, that's Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants, remembering this day 19 years ago today. Also on this anniversary, Local 3 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers hosted a special ceremony in honor of the 17 members who died on this day. The ceremony took place this morning in the courtyard of the Electrical Industry Center in Flushing, Queens, and included a reading of the names of the fallen brothers and sisters of Local 3. All right, we're going to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce, our segment with Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist, coming up next. Don't go away.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Wash your hands, avoid sick people, and touching your face. There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. It's America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Twitter handle. Don't forget that, AWF Union Podcast. You can follow us there. Let's go to line number one. Welcome one of our regulars, Jimmy Cullen, editor of the Progressive Populist, twice monthly magazine of politics, economics, general news. Trial subscription, just $18. It'll get you 6 months, 11 issues. You can get a free sample at the end of the show by calling this toll-free number, 1-800-205-7067, or visit them at populist.com. And today, Jimmy is going to run down his October 1st editorial, Make Trump the Loser. All right, Jimmy, it's all yours. Go ahead.
Yeah, the editorial has to do with if anything could budge the 43% of Americans who think Donald Trump is doing a good job, despite all the evidence to the contrary. Trump hasn't resorted to trying to shoot someone on Fifth Avenue in New York City to see if he could shake his supporters' loyalty, at least not yet. But the latest test was a report by Jeffrey Goldberg in the Atlantic magazine, September 3rd, that accused the president of calling fallen American soldiers suckers and losers and ducking out of a trip to a cemetery to honor U.S. Marines who died in World War I during a 2018 trip to Paris because it was raining and he didn't want to muss his hair. Trump also reportedly questioned the sacrifice of retired General John Kelly's son, Robert Kelly, and others who died in Afghanistan when Trump accompanied General Kelly to the son's gravesite in Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day 2017. Trump reportedly said of the fallen service members, quote, "I don't get it. What was in it for them?" unquote. Trump also asked his staff not to include wounded veterans in military parades on grounds that spectators would feel uncomfortable in the presence of amputees. "Nobody wants to see that," he said. Trump denied making the statements despite the Associated Press, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and even Fox News confirming the story. The Post also found a former senior administration official who said Trump had told senior advisors that he didn't understand why the U.S. government placed such value on finding soldiers who were missing in action because they had performed poorly and gotten caught and deserved what they got.
Unbelievable.
Significantly, John Kelly declined to speak on the record. And when Pentagon officials in a position to know declined to back up Trump, Trump called military brass war profiteers. And he claimed enlisted personnel support him, but a survey in Military Times of active duty military in late July and early August found that 49.9% have an unfavorable view of Trump and only 38% have a favorable view. Soldiers support Joe Biden over Trump by 4 points, which would be an extraordinary turnaround from 2016, when a poll using the same methodology showed Trump led Hillary Clinton by nearly 2-1, and 60% of veterans voted for Trump in 2016. As Amanda Marcotte noted Salon, we know Trump was lying in his denial of the Atlantic story because it follows his pathological pattern of telling lies. In his tweeted denials, Trump even claimed he never called the late Senator John McCain a loser for being captured during the Vietnam War, even though there's a recording of him doing so in 2015 in the same rant during which he declared, "I like people who weren't captured." Trump was so proud of this smear of McCain that he tweeted it out at the time. Trump's other tell, Marcotte noted, is that he falsely accuses others of doing what he himself has done. And in this case, Trump has spent years bashing athletes who kneel during the national anthem, falsely accusing them of dishonoring veterans and war dead. In truth, the tradition, which was started by former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, was formed with input from a former Green Beret sergeant as a way to speak out against racism and police brutality while still honoring the troops. Trump's contempt for the sacrifices of soldiers and their families was shown in 2016 when he smeared the family of Army Captain Humayun Khan, who was killed in action in Iraq in 2004, when Khan's parents spoke at the Democratic National Convention. And in October 2017, when Trump told a grieving widow of U.S. Army Sergeant LaDavid T. Johnson, who was killed in action in Niger, that he knew what he was signed up for. Trump then accused Representative Frederico Wilson, a Democrat of Florida, who was with the widow when she spoke with Trump, of lying when she spoke out about it. We can add these lies to the 2,055 falsehoods that Trump's already had claimed as president by the Washington Post tally as of July 9th, when Trump was telling an average of 23 false claims a day. They are reflected in polls that show Trump with 43.2% approval in an average compiled by 538.com, while 52.6% said they disapproved of Trump as of September 8th, and some 43.1% said they would vote to re-elect Trump, but 50.6% said they would elect Joe Biden. And Trump has never had more than 47.8% approval in the poll averages since he's been president, and disapproval only dipped below 50% briefly in April, before Trump's inability to control the coronavirus became apparent. And Biden has never trailed Trump since March, and Biden also leads by amounts greater than the margin of error in key swing states of Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, along with a narrow lead that has been about 2 or 3 points in Florida. So I know Trump, the Democrats are justifiably nervous about after the disastrous results in 2016, but this time Trump will not be sneaking up on his opponent. Voters have had a good look at Trump, and a majority of them don't like what they've seen. And in the 2018 election, Democrats made inroads into the suburbs, which Republicans have counted on to offset Democratic majorities in cities, and Democrats regained control of the House of Representatives. And as polls this year have shown, Biden leading among suburban voters, and Republican control of the Senate is at risk, an increasingly desperate Trump has tried to scare suburbanites with warnings that if Biden is elected, blacks will start moving into their neighborhoods, but racism doesn't appear to be moving the needle for Trump, at least not in a big way. So if anything, the share of Americans who say racism is a big problem in society has increased 8 percentage points in the past 2 years, and it's roughly doubled since 2011. Pew Research Center reported on August 29. And overall, 58% of Americans say racism is a big problem in our society, while 29% say it is somewhat of a problem, and just 12% say that racism in the U.S. is a small problem or not a problem at all, according to the Pew survey, which was conducted August 15th to the 21st. And despite Trump administration attempts to link the Black Lives Matter movement to riots, arson, and looting, some of which has been traced to right-wing provocateurs and other opportunists, the Pew poll found that 55% of Americans say they support BLM, while 34% oppose the movement. And Biden traveled to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on August 31st to underline that he supports peaceful protests that call for police reform and equal rights, but said those who engage in violent activities or looting should be prosecuted. And he also accused Trump of stoking violence in American cities. And Biden noted that America was unsafe under Trump, with COVID-19 killing thousands of people a week and an economy that's in tatters. And Biden also traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin to meet with the family of Jacob Blake, a black man who was gravely wounded after a white policeman shot him 7 times in the back. And Biden spoke with Blake by phone before meeting with community leaders and again opposed violence and looting, but pledged to go down fighting for racial equality and equity across the board. So with Trump's approval stuck in the low to mid-40s and Democrats targeting Senate Republicans in Alaska, Arizona, Colorado, Georgia, Iowa, Kentucky, Maine, Montana, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Texas, along with an open seat in Kansas, Republicans are trying to prevent opponents from voting, reducing the number of polling places and casting doubts on voting by mail. But many states allow early voting for several weeks in October. So check your earlier absentee voting options at vote.org or call your local election official, who's usually the county clerk, for details. And don't wait for November 3rd to vote.
There you go. That's the best advice you can give right now. Yeah, I got my absentee application just last week, so I sent it in, and I'm definitely going to vote early. And a lot of the polls indicate that 70, maybe 80% of people will vote by mail, obviously, if they get those ballots in time. So we'll see what happens here. Elections matter. We always say that on the show. You know, Jimmy, remember Ronald Reagan used to be called the Teflon president because you could throw anything at him and nothing seems to stick. And it seems like Donald Trump has beat him out on that one. It's hard to believe that 40 to 43% of Americans still support him after everything that has happened in the last 3.5 years. Hard to believe that, but that's the reality we live in today. Well, you take care, my friend. Progressive Populous, you can find everything online at populous.com. That toll-free number, once again, is 1-800-205-7067. You take care. We'll talk to you next month, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot.
Real good. We're going to take a quick break. Joyce Goldstein's going to run down the National Labor Relations Board. More bad news for workers. Also, an interesting ruling from the Ohio Supreme Court. Later in the show, the operating engineers out of New York City remembering 9/11. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this upcoming segment is brought to you by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Check them out online at oft-aft.org.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange, news, talk, sports, and workforce politics, the fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce. Don't forget, we are available on various platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify. And once again, we ask that you subscribe to our podcast network. Listen to the show. I know you'll love the show. And eventually give us a rating. 5-star rating would be greatly appreciated. Let's go to line number 2. Welcome one of our regulars here. Every month we check in with Joyce Goldstein. GoldsteinGregel.com is the website. Phone number is 216-771-6633. And she's here to cover labor issues, the erosion of worker rights. We're going to get into that with the National Labor Relations Board, which we touched on last month. But we have an interesting ruling here. Last month from the Ohio Supreme Court dealing with a company that makes a sterilizer, a hand sterilizer, which is pretty popular right now in the middle of a pandemic. Hey, Joyce, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us once again.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me again.
So this is a case called, Lunsford versus Sterilite. Lunsford versus Sterilite. What happened here, Joyce?
Well, the issue here is whether an employer can force an employee to submit to a drug test that requires the employee to urinate while a stranger watches their genitals. That's the issue. And the Ohio Supreme Court, in a decision by Justice Sharon Kennedy, no relation to the more popular and worker-friendly Kennedys, where Justice Kennedy said, nope, an employer's right to control its workplace is greater than an employee's right to keep his or her private parts private. So that's really the heart of the decision that was issued by the Ohio Supreme Court at the end of August.
Joyce, this had to be an interesting one to argue. I mean, you got a lot of visuals in this one, but I'm sorry. Go ahead. Give me some of the details here.
Yeah, sure. So there were four workers who filed a lawsuit against their employer, the Sterilite of Ohio. All four employees were at will, which, of course, means that they're not in a union and don't have any job security or job protection. And the company had a drug testing policy that allowed the company to require the workers to submit to a urinalysis if there was cause, like after an accident or suspicious behavior. But they also could just drug test randomly. But the drug testing policy never said how the urine samples would be collected. And under the policy, if a supervisor told an employee to go get tested, they had to produce a valid urine sample within 2.5 hours or they would be fired. So in the fall of 2016, all four of these employees, two happened to be male, two were female, they were all told to report for drug tests at designated restrooms. And when they got to those restrooms, they were required to sign a form that said that they consented to the drug test. And again, as I said, if they refused to sign the form, if they refused the test, they would have been fired. So, unsurprisingly, all four of them signed the form. And at the time they signed the form, they weren't told that someone would be watching their genitals while they urinated, euphemistically called the direct observation method. So, they went forward, and two of them urinated while they were being observed, and the other two tried but were unable to provide a sample while somebody was watching them.
Right,
and
right,
those
I
two,
understand.
Yeah, those two who were unable to urinate while being watched were immediately fired. So all four sued the company for invasion of privacy. And the company filed a motion to dismiss, which was granted by the trial court, and all four employees appealed. And it went to the 5th District Court of Appeals in Canton, Ohio, and the 5th District reversed the trial court and said that the employees, quote, have a reasonable expectation of privacy with regard to the exposure of their genitals, end of quote. Seems like a pretty obvious point, one would think, in civilized society.
One would think,
but
yes.
The company then appealed that decision to the Ohio Supreme Court, and the Ohio Supreme Court, as I said at the outset, reversed the Court of Appeals and ruled in favor of the company. And the Republican-controlled court ruled against the workers in an opinion by Justice Sharon Kennedy, who said that although the state of Ohio recognizes the right of privacy, an employee gives up that right just by going to work. She found that an employer's right to control its workplace is more important than, as I said, an employee's right to keep his or her private parts private. She also wrote that there couldn't be an invasion of privacy because the employees voluntarily consented to the drug test. So what's the problem? They agreed to it.
Well, yeah, they agreed to it, but they didn't expect somebody watching them, right?
Exactly. They didn't expect somebody watching them. And again, they didn't have any choice but to agree to it, because if they didn't agree to it, they were going to be fired, period. And of course, the two who agreed to it tried to pee under observation and were unsuccessful. They got fired anyway. So it wasn't really much of a choice, obviously. And that point was recognized by the dissent the opinion was written by Justice Melody Stewart, the Democrat, who wrote a pretty scathing dissent on behalf of herself, and Justice Donnelly, and also the Chief Justice joined. And Justice Stewart got really right to the heart of the matter, and she said if an employee agrees to something at the risk of losing his or her job, then the consent is not voluntary. It would obviously only seem voluntary to somebody who doesn't need a job. If you need to keep your job, then you agree to what you have to agree to. That's coercion. That's not voluntary. But what she said was that even employees at will who can be fired for any reason or no reason should still be protected from invasions of privacy. And here, Justice Stewart wrote that an employee's right to privacy was violated in two ways: the collection of the urine sample itself, and the intrusion into areas of the employee's private life that would otherwise remain unknown to the employer. And in a great quote, she said, there are few activities in our society more personal or private than the passing of urine. It's a function traditionally performed without public observation. Indeed, its performance in public is generally prohibited by law as well as social custom. End of quote. And she said, what happened to these employees was not much different than being an unwilling participant in a shotgun wedding, that they were forced to expose their genitals to third-party observers. So that's the case.
Oh, my gosh. Hard to believe. Yeah. Hard to believe. We should point out, too, that Justice Kennedy, who wrote this opinion, is currently up for re-election. And she is being challenged by a Democrat, John P. O'Donnell. So we'll see if this has any weight on voters' minds coming up. All right, let's move on to the NLRB. And last month, in fact, for the past couple of months, you and I have been talking about what's been going on there and just the continuation of the erosion of workers' rights. And today, I guess you want to talk about the general counsel. His name is Peter Robb, and the power that he has. And apparently, he's like the gatekeeper. If he doesn't think a case should go forward, he can say, sorry, that's not going to happen. And why don't you explain what's at play here, Joyce?
Sure. As we talked about the last time, in my view, the single most important position in the administration of federal labor laws in the United States is the position held by the NLRB's general counsel. Because, as you said, that person, and that person now is Peter Robb, who's a former management lawyer and union buster, that person is the gatekeeper. He's the he and his office that he administers throughout the country, they are the prosecutors. So they decide what cases get brought to the full National Labor Relations Board and what cases never see the light of day because they throw out the charges. They dismiss them before they ever even are fully litigated. So they're just thrown mm-hmm. out. And so it's a super powerful job. And what's been happening here is that the general counsel, Peter Raab, has been routinely throwing out charges filed by unions, filed by employees, before they ever have an opportunity to hold those employers to account.
Gotcha. All right. A lot of changes there. Unfortunately, not good for workers. All right, Joyce, we're going to button it up there. I know there's more. We'll hold those for next month. I want to give your firm a plug here. GoldsteinGrable.com, www.GoldsteinGrable.com. Phone number is 216-771-6633. This is a firm that represents public and private unions, fringe benefit funds, employees in construction, industrial service, professional, as well as law enforcement sectors. You take care. Be safe. We'll talk to you in October, okay?
Great. Thank you so much.
You got it, Joyce Goldstein. Love talking to her, really dissecting a lot of these opinions that we get here. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the International Union of Operating Engineers out of New York City, remembering this day 19 years ago today. It's all part of America's Workforce. Back in a few.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
LIUNA. The Laborers International Union of North America is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
The Food and Drug Administration has recently reported that the heartburn medication Zantac is linked to cancer. Zantac has been linked to a variety of cancers, which include bladder, colorectal, kidney, liver, pancreatic, and stomach. So if you or a loved one took Zantac and developed any of these types of cancer, you need to call Kelly and Ferraro, 216-575-0777. Let me repeat that number. 216-575-0777 for a free case review. You may be entitled to compensation from the drug manufacturer.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And welcome back to America's Workforce, where we are available on various platforms, and that includes Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify. Don't forget our Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. You can follow us there. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the fine folks at the United Labor Agency, doing what they can to connect people with employment. Good jobs. 216-666-2185. You can find them online at ulagency.com. ulagency.com. Let's go to line number three and welcome to the show Thomas Hart. Thomas is president of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 94. Local94.com is a website. And as you know, today is a day we are all remembering, September 11th, 2001, and what happened in the heart of New York City. Mr. Hart, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. I really look forward to speaking with you.
So where were you on this day 19 years ago?
19 years ago today was a primary day here in New York City for an election, for local elections. So I had met up in Queens. We cover the five boroughs in New York. I met up in Queens with one of the candidates that we were supporting, so that we could leaflet and help this person get elected into city council. I had a meeting set up to go up to the Bronx after I was done there, so jump over bridge, go over the Bronx. But at about 7:15, I started to head out for my meeting, and I got a call on my cell phone from one of my colleagues in the office. He's like, we're going to go up to the Bronx, we're going to do the meeting real quick, and we got to get back. A small plane just hit the Trade Center. Now, I'm on the LIE. I could see the Trade Center in my rearview mirror, and I look back, you know, I said, John, that's not a small plane. I said, this thing is huge. He's like, all right, just get, you know, let's get up to, you know, the Bronx and do what we got to do, and we'll come back down. I went to go over the Throgs Neck Bridge, which connects Queens and the Bronx, to get to my meeting, and I watched the second plane hit the tower. It was just unfathomable, unthinkable, just bizarre. We get to our meeting, we go into the meeting. My boss was there at the time. John was there. We both represent that property. So it was a meeting. I think we're starting the contract negotiations. And, you know, we made the meeting quick, and the guys came into the room. Now, I'm a degreed engineer by trade, also an operating engineer. And they came in and said that the World Trade Center just collapsed. I'm like, oh, my God, there's no way. There's no way the Trade Center collapsed. Sure enough, went out, and I've seen it over probably 1,000 times. See it in my head every day when the plane, they showed the plane hitting, and then they showed the time lapse, and they showed the collapse. And all I could think about at that time was how many people were going to perish as a result of this. The saving grace that we didn't lose more lives was the fact that it was a primary day. People mm-hmm. stayed home to either go vote, or the schools were closed, and they had to take care of their children. So.
Yeah,
the fact that it happened on that day did save a lot of lives, but we did lose a lot of lives. So we ended our meeting. Now, I have credentials from the Department of Labor. I have all kinds of health and safety credentials, and we tried to get back down to lower Manhattan. The city went into lockdown. We're absolutely were not allowed anywhere. We got down to a certain point and couldn't get any further. It took me like 6 hours to go home that night, because everything was in chaos. And I only live, you know, an hour's drive from Manhattan. We were unable to get down to Manhattan. We had guys in the office. They stayed overnight. I got in here like 5:30 in the morning. I came up out of the train station, the Penn Station, and I knew it wasn't going to be good. It was heavily armed. I mean, Jeeps with machine guns on them. Like, we rolled out. We rolled in. There were heavily armed people everywhere, and I knew it wasn't going to be good. Got into the office. We had a quick meeting. We were missing, you know, we had bodies. We had people all over the place. I shouldn't say bodies yet, but we had engineers all over the place. We couldn't account for it. On the phone all night. I had people calling at home. You know, we went into like a triage, you know, mode, because our guys are based in the buildings. We have crews in the buildings, in each and every one of those buildings. It got to the point where, you know, go out and do what you can. My initial stop was at the Central Labor Council. So look, we got a problem. We got bodies. We're missing, you know, a few men, you know, I think it was about 18 guys that we couldn't account for. So the next step was I went over to, the hospitals on the east side, and it was such an eerie feeling. When I went over there, because it was a beautiful day. The birds were chirping. It was absolutely sunny, beautiful, beautiful day. And nurses, doctors were all lined up. The emergency triage, everything was set up, but there were no ambulances coming. There was just nothing happening. It was just dead silence of the birds. It was a beautiful morning, but there was no rescue. There was nobody coming out of it. And the family started growing there. You know, they started to grow to look for their loved ones. And that's the first time that we saw the pictures of the people, which I still see vividly in my mind. Everywhere you walk in the city, you know, if you see this person, please call. And it was a long, long process. So I located three of our guys at Bellevue. They were taken there. reported that back to the office. So my next step was to get down, all I could think about was to get down to ground zero, because we had engineers that knew every step of that place, every inch of that place, and, you know, they could get them on the ground because you could still get around on the ground in some of it. And I wound up hooking up with a sheriff. He came down, he said, what can I do for you? I told him who I was. He took me to the command center, which things like this happened throughout the whole course for me. I went to the command center. He dropped me off, and there was a policeman at the center, the mayor, the governor. This is their center for, you know, command. And I told him who I was. I gave him my card, and he looked at me. He goes, I know who you are. I'm like, how do you know who I am? He was a member and assistant local in Local 30, and he worked with my father before he went on the police force.
How about that?
Like, and things like that happened throughout the whole time.
Yeah.
And he says, listen, I know how you guys are. If you walk through this threshold and I go, I'm going to get somebody that can help you. But if you come in here, I have to arrest you. I said, listen, if you're going to help me, I'm not going anywhere. I said, this is serious stuff. He goes, I know. So he brought out a captain from the emergency service unit. He looked like a bulldog. And he looked up at me and goes, with this New York smirk, he says, who are you? I told him. And he said to me, you come down with me, you'll ride with me. He had his car and like six trucks backed up ready to go. And his driver came out, and I'm a pretty big guy, but this guy made me look small. And it took about 20 minutes to get downtown, and we got to know each other pretty quickly. He goes, where do you want to go? I said, Cap, I really don't know. I said, So we wound up on the West Side Highway where the North Bridge had collapsed. And he's like, we got to go. I said, listen, just be safe. Godspeed, just be safe. Because when we got down there, the magnitude of what we saw was just unbelievable, unfathomable. And when I got out of the car, he went his way with his men, and I just kind of walked over. There were several hundred firemen, and the bridge had collapsed. That's where the bridge had collapsed on all the fire trucks. And that's where the majority of the firemen were when we pulled them out. They were all over the pile, but that's where they were. And I grabbed one lieutenant, so I handed him my card. I said, listen, I'm here. And right away I knew what he was, he was looking for his people. Everybody was in shock. Everybody was in a state of shock walking around. And I said to him, we're here. This is who I am. We have access in my office. We have guys that, basically help build the building, that know the building. We can help you. And then it became a rescue mission. I stood on the corner and, directed trucks, backed in trucks, people coming to me, asking me to put them on a payroll. I said, we don't have a payroll. You have to, let's just stay here, sign up, put your name down somewhere. I said, we'll figure this all out later. And I stayed there till about 7 o'clock that night, removing debris and organizing things and just kind of lend a hand. And that's it was such a dark time here. But the one thing that I want to point out is how the good side of New York, good side of New York is the humanity, how people turned out. It didn't matter who you were, whether you were union, non-union, it didn't matter. Unemployed, employed, people turned out and they just lent a hand any way they could, in any way that they could. And it was really a tough time to be in New York, but it was a beautiful time in New York. You would get on an elevator throughout the whole process and people would say good morning. And there was a genuine concern for each other, and it showed a side of New York that nobody really knows. I'm happy to say that, So that evening I got up after moving, I didn't find one complete body part. One complete body. I found nothing but parts, body parts, moving remains. And I finally, I had young kids at home. I said, look, I got to get out of here. So I grabbed one of the dump truck drivers. I said, can you give me a ride up the West Side Highway? He's like, where do you got to go? I said, I got to go to Penn Station. I said, I had enough of this. I was there probably about 10 hours just, doing what we were doing, what everybody was doing. And the sun was coming down. It was getting dark. And it was the most moving thing that I've ever experienced. When we went up the West Side Highway, people were cheering, clapping, candles. People just turned out, and I cried. I cried. I got home, and it became an obsession. It became an obsession for all of us that were here. because we wanted to make a difference. We wanted to, you know, see this through. And there were a lot of people missing at the time. You know, we're starting to find out who's missing, who's not missing, who's in the hospital, who's not in the hospital. People walked home. You know, they would grab a ferry to New Jersey, and then they walked from Jersey. You know, a couple of guys lived in Brooklyn. They walked. You couldn't. There was no cell phone service. There was no real car service. It was just people lending a hand. And you know, I have stories of guys that got into Jersey and then walked home to Brooklyn, which is, if you know anybody's familiar with New York, that's a pretty big undertaking. And you couldn't reach those people, so we didn't know how they were, what they, you know, if they were alive or what. You know, it took days to locate where everybody was. You know. And we had four guys that we never located, you know, and one of them, his wife called my house, you know, she got my home phone number, my cell phone number, called. And I finally said to her, I said, Sally, if I find Vito, you're going to be the first person I call. There's nothing, you know, we're looking hard. We're finding out there's a lot of people working on this. We never found Vito.
Oh.
And, you know, we still, today is a day, you know, it's a day of remembrance. And we're 19 years out. And as I tell the story, it's like I have a burning in my heart. It's like it was yesterday. That's how vivid it
right.
is for us that we're here. You know, but what we do every year is we vowed never to forget here. That's our logo for 9/11 for our members and to the people. It wasn't just our members. It was other tradespeople. It was people that just came to work. Innocent people came to work mm-hmm. and never went home. So we vowed never to forget. And we have a memorial mass for the families. The children naturally were all growing up now, but they were younger. Some of them had children. Some of them didn't. But the four families come, wives, children, parents of the deceased, they come, the members turn out and support at the Mass at St. Malachy's. And I'm happy to say, even in the COVID world today, we're going to continue that tradition. We're going to have a virtual Mass. We're going to be able to hold a certain amount of people, and we expect some of the members there. But in that virtual Mass, it'll be on our website. People can follow it, you know, as it's going on.
All right, that's local94.com, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And the other thing is that the light tower, there was a whole issue on whether or not the light towers, the blue light towers, which symbolized the Trade Center, if they would be lit this year. And thank God people seen to it that it did happen. The Tunnel the Towers helped get that done. It's another organization mm-hmm. that does a lot of good work here.
So, Tom, what was the total amount of people that died on Local 94 for your local there?
We have four that perished that day, but
yeah.
One thing that folks need to keep in mind when we say we'll never forget, I serve on a couple of advisory committees. I serve on the 9/11 Health Watch, which helped get the Sidroga Act passed. We have people perishing today as a result of what they were exposed to back then. We've had some members that have perished. And the further out we get from this, people, they don't link what they're going through to what they were exposed to down there.
Yeah.
And there's one specific group that I worry about. The union people, we get the word out. I've done a lot of outreach with Mount Sinai and the different groups. But the one group that's significant that I don't really think there's been much documented on were the children that were in school down there around the area. And, you know, I don't know that as they get older, if they have some issues that might be related, that they'll be able to link that. So those are some of the people that we have to continue to work on and get to, you know, and reach out. And we have those discussions, you know.
A lot of unfinished business, no doubt about it. Thank you, Tom. Thomas Hart, president of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 94 out of New York City. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, more on worker safety, the Better Business Bureau, and Labor's International. Until then, all of you, have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.